You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's guest is Alok Sama, who is the former president and CFO of SoftBank Group International. He previously served as a managing director at Morgan Stanley. He's got an amazing new book. It's called The Money Trap, Lost Illusions Inside the Tech Bubble. You're going to love this one.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch.
Alok Sama, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
I suspected that this book of yours was not going to be the standard business memoir, which is normally filled with like earnest and banal leadership platitudes, when the very first quote you cite is from Martin Amis's London Fields, maybe my favorite book. And that Amis quote is, novelists don't usually have it so good, do they, when something real happens, something unified, dramatic, and pretty saleable, and they just write it down. So talk why you use that. How does that set up the book?
Well, first of all, I love that you picked up on that. I mean, sounds like we're Amis fans. And what I love about Amis's writing is he's just never boring.
No.
And as I set out to write this book, the one thing I was determined not to be was boring. And, you know, you talked about business memoirs. I never read business books, to be quite honest. And as I talk about in this book towards the end anyway, I actually got myself, writing is something I always wanted to do. I got myself a 2-year graduate degree in MFA program at NYU, which is a phenomenal experience. We could talk about that. And, you know, I didn't go there with the intention of writing this book or writing a memoir. I actually wanted to write fiction. And as I experimented, as one does in graduate school, you know, it's sort of an exercise and, you know, throwing up stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks, I kind of realized that what I experienced over kind of 6 years before I got my MFA degree, you know, it involved a lot of the ingredients of what would make for a really cool fiction type book. I mean, you know, there's kind of complex, larger than life characters, this Masa-san, richest man in the world, and then, you know, gets into the Guinness Book of World Records for having lost the most money ever. There's action and intrigue, there's tragedy. I mean, I lose both my parents and my dog, which is quite traumatic. There's no sex, but there is a honey trap. all the ingredients of what could kind of go into an interesting work of fiction, it was all in there. And so it became, hence the quote, it becomes an exercise of pulling all of that together and collating it, even though it's all reality, it's all very real, kind of collating this into kind of a coherent narrative, which is how this book came about.
So when I wrote my book, it also featured friends and family. Right. And like yours, it was a book about both business and my story and, you know, and larger themes and culture. I'm curious, did you talk to your friends and family about the fact that you were going to write about them and how did that shake out?
You know, it is, I do talk about this in the acknowledgement section. It's tough writing a memoir because you're writing about real people and it's inhibiting. I mean, you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? I mean, at the back of your mind, there's always this thing about, well, how are they going to react? And to answer your question directly, I did run once I had a good first version of the book I did run it by some of the people who featured fairly prominently. And even though, you know, it's not uniformly positive in terms of, you know, some of the characters, they kind of got that to capture some of the complexity. I had to depict them, you know, kind of had to make them real. And and they were, but with almost without exception, they were very accepting of that. My family was great. I mean, both my kids, my wife features prominently, my son, my daughter, perhaps a little bit less so, not that I love her any less, but you know, they all looked at the book, they had input into the draft. So it was, I wouldn't call it a collaborative effort, but they certainly had an option to, the option to give me feedback, which they did quite liberally.
Your publicist had checked in with me, and I had sort of said, I'm like, you didn't tell me this was like a spy thriller, which is how it begins. And there's an improv adage, which is start in the middle. You kind of do that with the first line of your prologue where you say, someone wants me out of the way.
Yeah.
So let's just jump into that. Yeah. What happened?
And I say that twice. Someone desperately wants me out of the way. Well, look, I mean, this smear campaign, well, what happened specifically was I was in this job, incredibly high-powered, globally significant, systemically significant, because my boss, Masayoshi Son, had raised this gargantuan $100 billion fund. It was the largest pool of private capital ever assembled. And you know, we own things like Sprint, which we merged with T-Mobile. We bought, we spent $22 billion in ride-sharing, you know, $8 billion into Uber, DoorDash. I mean, a lot of household names, American mm-hmm. household names were part of that portfolio. WeWork was a very prominent investment, you know, kind of made a movie, a couple of books out of that. So it was high profile, and because of my role as Masa's deal maker in chief, someone saw me as a target. And this whole smear campaign, kind of writing stories about me, writing nasty letters accusing me of being, you know, doing all kinds of nefarious stuff, a complaint filed with the Indian equivalent of the FBI, completely, you know, garbage claims. But it's interesting in this day and age how easy it is to trash someone's reputation by just asking questions. And it was extraordinarily hurtful from a personal perspective. So I talk about that. You know, I don't give the reader a resolution, which I can totally see from a reader perspective would be, I mean, if this was a novel, a work of fiction, that would be unforgivable, right? I mean, I set you up to expect, like, you know, there's a crime and there's a victim, you know, kind of, okay, well, who did it, right? But reality kind of gets complicated. So it ends without resolution. And while there's been, you know, there was a very prominent Wall Street Journal, front page Wall Street Journal article that pointed the finger at an individual, I can't in good conscience point a finger at anyone because I don't have definitive proof. But mm-hmm. that whole campaign, in terms of some of the bizarre things that happened, the book starts off with me meeting with two Mossad agents who were going to help me. I'd hired Kroll Associates, which is some of your listeners might be familiar, probably the best known investigative agency in the United States, probably globally, actually, to help them get to the bottom of this. They didn't furnish any proof, but there's some interesting shenanigans along the way. And you know, I was under surveillance. I mean, I talk about that, you know, kind of these Mossad guys show me pictures of my house in London, my home in San Francisco. You know, there was a stakeout basically. And it was really, really creepy to kind of see this kind of being played out in front of me.
So you and I are, I think, almost exactly the same age. And mm-hmm. I have like the total low stakes version of this in my world, because I ran Second City for 20 some odd years. There's at some point, and I'm guessing it was a disgruntled actor who I let go, but sort of fake anthrax showed up at the office. We had to evacuate the entire offices. This was not in the full blown internet day, but there was sort of like weird allegations that were showing up in different places.
Yeah.
There was an ex Second City actor who is now a Chicago cop who we hired, actually did it for free, who tried to figure out who this was. And around a little bit, actually, before that, there was a theater company here in town who put up a show called Second City Doesn't Want Us. It was all people that we didn't hire. There was a very terrible depiction of me. And I remember I was very upset about it. And I remember talking to my dad. And my dad, who was a theater reviewer, actually saw the show.
Right.
And he said to me, he goes, Kelly, do you respect these people? And I go, no. And he goes, why do you care?
Yeah.
And I was just like, well, that's easy for you to say. But yeah. It was good. But it was good advice. And you say in the book, quote, a friend pointed out, when people start writing letters to boards about you, it means you finally arrived. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But it doesn't stop the human thing of like, this sucks.
No, it's hurtful, man. No, it was really hurtful. And you know, it is just the feeling in times like you've been through something similar and you know exactly what I'm talking about. Just the feeling that someone hates you enough to want to damage you. It is, you know, I'm supposed to be this Wall Street guy. I'm supposed to be thick-skinned and all of that good stuff. Yeah. And, you know, but man, it hurt. It really hurt.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
All right. So some of the early stuff. I mean, not to stereotype you. You say it yourself. Liv, your dad wanted you to go into medicine, which feels very on point.
Yeah.
But you didn't want to.
Well, yeah. I mean, I talk about. I actually wanted to be a mathematician, and I was turned off medicine when I was a kid. I think I must have been about 10 or 11. My father was, he was actually a scientist. He was a doctor, but he was at a teaching hospital. And a couple of his students, if you can believe, took me, and I might have been under 10 at the time, they actually took me to the morgue, you know, where they kind of do autopsies and stuff, which is kind of like, if you just think about it, that was kind of a weird, twisted thing to do to a kid. Mm-hmm. And somehow that just really stuck in my mind. So I never really went near medicine, but I actually wanted to be, just growing up in India back in the 80s, I actually wanted to be, I was a total math geek. And I'm talking about pure math, you know, number theory. I wanted to, you know, solve this obscure thing called Fermat's Last Theorem. And I knew very little about America, as I talk about it. I mean, I used to listen to Springsteen and Dylan and Paul Simon, and that was you know what I knew of America, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you had literally those days 2.5 hours of black and white television in India, and so it was, and the movies you saw. I mean, you didn't get to see stuff like, you know, Taxi Driver that would show you the grid of New York. You just saw complete, and you saw stuff like spaghetti westerns and, you know, Clint Eastwood. I mean, that was America for me, right? And I just had this chance encounter with someone my father knew who was a mathematician, and he met me at my college, and I talk about this in the opening of the book. And as it turns out, he taught statistics at the Wharton School in Philadelphia. And I'd never heard of the Wharton School. And, you know, he kind of told me about it and kind of convinced me that doing an MBA in finance would open up all kinds of optionality, might make as much as $50,000 a year, which just seemed like a ridiculous amount of money. And I said, yeah, okay. I mean, those days, this is actually an interesting piece of economic history. I mean, this is India in the 70s and 80s. I call that chapter, when I talk about sort of my origin story, Born to Run. And a whole generation of us just left the country because this Fabian socialism, which was just a miserable economic failure, just drove, you know, anyone who could got out. And it's got to be the most economically consequential brain drain, and the United States benefited from it in the history of mankind, possibly. Right. I mean, you see Indians in Silicon Valley. I mean, I did some math around this. I think you look at CEOs of S&P 500 companies, Indian origin CEOs, it was as much as 15%. I mean, that includes Google, Microsoft, Adobe, IBM. It's included Pepsi. It's included MasterCard. I mean, you know, it's actually quite phenomenal.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I just first of all, we share our taste of music is almost exactly aligned, so that was fun for me.
Cool, yeah.
But also this idea of, I mean, you're meeting with Dick Cheney, you're flying on, you know, Gulfstream jets.
Yeah.
There's money everywhere, and the most money everywhere.
Yeah.
But yet through all of it, and this is what I'm curious about.
Yeah.
How much came later, and how much was always in your mind at the time that maybe the money has actually nothing to do with the happiness or what even success means?
Yeah, I mean, I think that realization, I have to say, came much, much later in life, right? Yeah. Because you start off and you come to this country, and I wasn't thinking happiness. I was thinking about, man, I gotta make a living, right? I mean, you know, my parents were, you know, kind of later in life, my father became a wealthy man, but we were middle class in India, and I described that, I anchored that in the metaphor of middle class in India meant you know, ceiling fans instead of air conditioning, right? I mean, we didn't own a car. The only family vehicle was a two-wheeler Vespa, kind of Italian made in India, but licensed from Italy, scooter. So, you know, you come from that background, and the first thing you want to do is make a little bit of money. Well, you want to get a green card too, by the way. I mean, that is the, from an immigrant perspective, that literally is the holy grail, and you want to make a little bit of money. And I got to the Wharton School, and I knew nothing about finance, but it came naturally because I was a math geek, and there's a lot of math. You know, those courses came very easily to me. And I saw this guy, and I described this meeting. He came to speak at Wharton, Michael Milken. And now Milken at the time was, you know, kind of compare, use the Greek tragedy comparison, you know, he was a hero in every sense of the word. And because he'd created this parallel capital market, the high yield market, and I saw this guy, he's a skinny Jewish kid, a little bit of what I was when I came to Wharton. I said, man, look what he pulled off. And he did some really geeky research when he was at Wharton, and he became incredibly rich. And by the way, he made a real impact on the world. And what I didn't see coming, obviously, was what happened next. I mean, Milken, obviously, you know, kind of this is the ultimate. He became, from being this iconic hero in the financial markets, to being sort of the poster child for 80s excess, ended up in jail. I didn't see that coming, right? I mean, that's the Greek element of it. You know, heroes are flaws, frequently fatal, as I say. You know, he was a little bit, he was everyone's role model. And so I wanted to go to finance, and I lucked out. I landed a job at Morgan Stanley, you know, as waspy as it gets at the time. You know, the typical profile of my workmates were, you know, probably been to Exeter or Andover. That being undergrad was Yale, and it was always Harvard Business School. The Indians and the Jews went to the Wharton School. I mean, it was Yale, Princeton, HBS. That was the background. And frequently, to the degree they had jobs or roles in between, if they weren't on Wall Street, they worked for the U.S. Marine Corps or, you know, kind of, yeah, it was that type of background. And it was just really strange being thrown in with that group. And by the way, not to suggest that I experienced discrimination in any way.
Yeah,
these were incredibly bright, hardworking, decent people. I could be part of their social life, but I looked up to them. I learned a lot from them and assimilating, learning to speak like them, dress like them. It was really interesting. I mean, in America, particularly Wall Street and a place like Morgan Stanley, did that to you in terms of the pressure to assimilate. And one of the things I do touch on a lot in my book is this issue of identity and immigrant identity. And I recount how with my boss, Masa Son, we make this trip to India, and we meet with the Indian Prime Minister, Modi. Now, you know, in my mind, first 21 years of my life, I'd barely been outside Delhi. So there was still an element of, like, a meeting, without getting into Modi's politics, and there's a kind of a Trumpy aspect to it, but let's not go there. But I'm still meeting with the Indian Prime Minister. For me, it's kind of a big deal. And I go up to him, and I do a very traditional Indian, you know, kind of bow down and do a traditional fold my hands, do a namaste. And he ignores that. He just kind of sticks his hand out and gives me a very firm, very, you know, Western handshake. And that kind of stuck in my mind, which is, I think of myself as, like, you know, I'm in Delhi. This is sort of my prime minister. But he doesn't see me as Indian at all. You know, I'm this, like, you know, kind of wearing an Italian suit, a fancy designer, you know, European tie. I'm this foreign banker. That's what he's been briefed, and that's how he treats me. So, yeah, this whole image thing, and then I lose my parents, and I struggle with that. You know, where you're from is a lot about where your parents are from. And then when you lose your parents, you know, there's the sense of being displaced more than a little bit. So that's a lot of what I wanted to tease out in the book beyond some of the complex deal issues and some of the money issues that you talked about, the issue of identity.
Yeah, it reads and it's I'm intrigued by the business story as well, but that alone to me it'd be fine. Yeah. But it was the other idea, because this comes up in the podcast a lot because we interview a lot of social scientists, which is this idea. It's a very Western idea that your authentic self is one self, right? Yeah. And that's just not true. We are many selves in many different contexts, and you show that in terms of an immigrant, but also someone who then accumulates wealth.
Yeah.
Someone who is a son and a husband and a parent. And and I just lost my dog, literally.
As that's so relatable, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's like, it's the worst. And it was like, 2 days of sobbing it's still the house feels so empty and all that. And then of course losing your parents, and I've lost a child. And it's like all this stuff makes you who you are, which is, and you still are that human who then goes to work.
Yes.
Yeah. And has to make it. And that's what's so interesting, I think, and unusual about the book, because the reason I was interested in booking you is I'm fascinated by the WeWork story. We had on the former Melissa Daimler, who ran HR for WeWork. I don't think very long. And, her story of first meeting Adam was she was pregnant. He was barefoot and he was inappropriate.
Yeah,
I don't know why she took. And you even say you sniffed the snake oil with regard to that. I don't know if it was a first meeting.
Well, the first sighting, certainly. I mean, I describe how I saw him speaking at this big event in India. And he starts talking about how, he has a solution for India's housing problem. And I'm kind of thinking, I knew what WeWork did, which is, kind of its temporary office space. And it's temporary office space with a difference. And you have, the whole community thing going. But I don't get how that solved India's middle class housing problem. I mean, it is. And I said, my the exact words were, my bullshit meter redlined. And when I saw him in action, I mean, he was silky smooth, man. He was the goat. This is as good as it gets when it comes to salesmanship.
Well, and isn't Mark Andreessen just giving him a bunch of money?
Well, I find that quite remarkable. It's funny you picked up on that. You're right. After that WeWork fiasco, arguably the biggest fiasco in the history of venture investing, SoftBank's losses were north of $10 billion. Yeah, he turns around and without a penny in revenue, pretty much to do sort of the same thing over again, he gets money from Andreessen Horowitz. It's quite remarkable. I mean, God bless America, man. I mean,
I guess.
This is, I just do not understand how you pull that up. And by the way, I mean, the other weird thing about Andreessen Horowitz backing him is I go out of my way to point out in the book that I never got how WeWork was a technology company. Right. And the idea of Andreessen, whatever you think about Andreessen, it's a pedigreed venture capital firm. It's not as if a real estate guy is backing Adam. I mean, it just I really struggle with this.
So Masa-san is I think the sort of central the Kurtz like figure in this Heart of Darkness that reference, and he. You write that he says, quote, my goal is happiness for everyone. Nobody should be sad. I want technology to make people happy, end quote. I've looked over that quote again and again.
Yeah.
And it's something sort of fundamentally, sort of beautifully naive about it.
It is. That's a wonderful way to describe it, by the way. Okay. But finish your thought. I mean,
it's at one point you're like, that's lovely.
Yeah.
And another point, you're like, it is impossible to happen. And because those two things exist in the same sentence, that's the ultimate tension of this whole experience, of this book, of him and him as a character. Because amazing. I just had this argument with a colleague about Elon Musk.
Yeah,
which is the list of the net positives, and then the list of the negatives. And I think it was Scott Galloway who said the other day something about like what does net mean in this with regard to that? And again, going back to this idea that this theme, which is we're all many things. So maybe it's naive to think in terms of good and evil and bad and, you know, all that. And because you don't, this thing doesn't end with, as you said, you know, we don't catch the killer.
Yeah. Yeah. No, well, there's a lot to unpack there, but the, I think there's a, let's not make too much of the happiness piece of the happiness for everyone. I think with Masa-san, and I know him well enough, and I've lived with the man for 5 years to understand this. I think what he's really talking about is this sense of idealism. And I'll come back to Elon Musk because there's elements of the same, though you know, the paths diverge. But it's interesting to talk about. But you know, what Musk is really getting at is idealism in terms of using technology to make our lives better. Right. I mean, it's going back to kind of the General Electric, as I say, was a technology company once upon a time. Thomas Edison's company, you know, light bulbs, you know, you can argue that made lives better for people. You know, the printing press that made lives. I mean, it created a lot of bad stuff along the way in terms of what was written initially. But let's not go there. Harari talks about in his book what happened after the witches. But eventually we can agree, you know, if you're as big a fan of books as I am, that the printing press books made life better for people, right? So to me, that's a lot of what Marcel is getting at, is using technology to make lives better. Happiness, you know, kind of that confuses the issue, and we could get overly philosophical about that. And by the way, that is part of what I really admire about Elon Musk. Now, I'll say this at the outset, you know, he is deservedly the most pillory billionaire out there, and I actually am saddened to see how he has, and I really think unraveled is the right word, but I also deeply admire what he's done in terms of using technology to solve problems, because if we can agree that climate change is the biggest problem of our times, I would absolutely put up what he's done against Al Gore or Obama or Biden, in fact, all of them put together. Because pulling off what he did with electric cars is, people do not appreciate how monumental that was in terms of upturning an industry, right? I mean, you know, you eliminate dealerships, you eliminate the middleman, you don't start with an assembly line and just stick a battery in a car. That's not, you know, the economics don't work. You start off with a battery and a computer and you design a car around that. And the technological challenges associated with that, with scaling up that business, was monumental. And everyone told him, bet against him, told him it could be done. SpaceX, you know, the idea of reusable rockets and how much money that saved NASA. Now, whatever you want to say about the space program, just accept that as an American taxpayer, there's a monumental amount of money that NASA spends firing up these rockets that just kind of blow up. And, oh, you know, they explode and this stuff, this debris just falls down to Earth. Well, the idea of Musk coming up with the idea of a rocket that goes and lands and you can reuse it, it's pretty damn cool. And it saves billions of dollars. So, yeah, the man's ability to use technology to solve real issues, to improve people's lives, to improve the environment, it's very cool. But, you know, unlike Masa, he just completely unravels. Now, you know, his what he's done with Twitter or X or some of his other kind of bizarre antics, a little bit, which I talk about, that's just seriously, seriously weird stuff. But Musk has taken care of that. I mean, you know, he's just focused on technology, making the world a better place. And for him, it's all about AI now.
Yeah. Well, and there with Musk, you can see the double-edged sword of technology, right? So he's creating sort of these technological solutions, and then he is swallowed by the technology when he goes into the social media sphere to like, it can't, there's no self-regulation suddenly. And I think your gap,
that's got nothing to do with technology, by the way. I mean, he's gone into, you know, call it politics, or I'm not even sure what to call it. I mean, he's just,
that's it. Yeah. It's, but none of us would even know it if he wasn't on Twitter.
Yes. No, that's true. Yeah.
So, but I think your Gatsby reference ties all of this stuff together, which is these we've seen these warnings, whether it's in Shakespeare or other things, you know, flying too close to the sun. It's the hubris that comes out of this. And we're all guilty of it in certain ways. Yeah. You just happen to work for someone. The money was astronomical. Yes. And it was twice, right? Didn't it lost it all, made it all, lost it all?
Yeah. And then made it all back again, right? I mean, so this is the thing. This is where our, you know, we've told ourselves these stories, Greek tragedy, Icarus flying close to the sun. Well, this is a case of an Icarus who flew close to the sun and he got burned and he fell, but, you know, then he flew again and he got burned and now he's flying higher than ever. So, you know, it is some of those stories kind of break down a little bit but this is, you know, this is the beauty of reality. It's just much, much more complex than some of the stories we tell ourselves.
Do you think you have a novel in you now, having done this one?
I am working on a novel, and if you're a Martin Amis fan, you might appreciate this. It's an old story he wrote in The New Yorker. It's called Career Moves, and it's an imagined world, typical Amis style, kind of a satire, a world in which being a poet is the easiest way to make money.
and I'm
playing with ideas around that, kind of trying to develop a plot. But the beauty of, if you're an Amis fan, you know what I love about him is it's never about the plots; it's always about the writing. And I want to see if I can get away with that, but give it more of a novel structure, a story structure. So that's kind of what I'm playing with, and that's what I mean. I wanted to write fiction, so I want to really get back to that.
Yeah. Oh, but I can see why this made sense. We often talk to our talent here. You know, at Second City, we create our shows through improvisation, so it's an ensemble. Getting suggestions from an audience, us spitting back, and we do short scenes and longer scenes and songs and that sort of thing. But in essence, we tell everyone, you know, you want to work from what you know. You expand from there, and you create characters that are clearly not yourself. But the truths, the you know, relationships, you're grabbing everything from your own experience, because if you're not doing that, everyone's going to see that it's not true. And so this idea of being able to, you know, have this practice of because it does, this reads like a novel. It's very well written. Story is intriguing, and all of that. So I think I don't know that you get to a really good first novel without doing something like this first. It's my guess.
Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, you know, we shall see. It'll be an adventure.
We always end our conversations asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple. I'll give you the, you know, and they're both in the book. You know, there is a for those of you in the appetite, you know, kind of from a business perspective, you know, I tell this story about this big deal, this merger between two companies most Americans will be familiar with, Sprint and T-Mobile. And, you know, we get them to say yes, in other words, merge. But that's when the games begin, because, you know, you got to go through a tortuous process, which we try to do once and fail, of going to lobbying all the way up and down from the President of the United States to the Department of Justice and to the Federal Communications Commission and to the state governments, a couple of whom serve. So, you know, getting to yes in a business context, you know, shaking hands on a deal is really where it all begins. So, I thought that was sort of interesting. And then the other kind of getting the yes thing that unfolds in the book also is, you know, I got into SoftBank, which is this conglomerate based in Tokyo, Masa-san's company, really based on a relationship with a really close friend, Nikesh Arora. And, you know, kind of we talk and we kind of get to a yes, which is, yeah, look, buddy, love you. We'll have fun working together. But then there's this complexity of meeting Masa-san, getting comfortable with him and learning about him. And, you know, kind of the process from like saying yes to truly kind of buying into his vision and becoming completely engaged. Is there's the technicality of saying yes, and then there's buying in, which kind of unfolded over time for me. So those are the two examples I could think of in the context of my story anyway.
The book is called The Money Trap, Lost Solutions Inside the Tech Bubble. Alok Sama, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. It was fun. Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox The Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.